Today is December the 11th, 2019.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your service. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, it's 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org.
We have lined up for tonight the following. The evolution of the television delivery platform. T-Mobile's nationwide 5G network isn't nationwide, just really a slightly faster 4G overhype. When it comes to 5G network, North America will get the fastest speed earlier. Mark Liasso has a review on Western Digital My Passport. How to refresh Windows 10 without a factory reset. Benjamin Rockwell in his IT Pro series, auditing computers for hardware software patches. The FBI recommends that you keep your Internet of Things devices on a separate network.
Presenting Marty Winston, why you can see in 2D, but hearing needs 4D. The evolution in the television delivery platform. According to data from the 2018 American Time Use Survey, conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that collects information about how people use their time, not all of those TV-watching Americans are getting their televised entertainment through traditional means. When it comes to TV subscribers, 2018 was a year of the snip. USA Today reported that cable providers lost around 1.1 million subscribers in the third quarter of 2018 alone, while over 725,000 left satellite providers. So why did millions of Americans choose to cut the cord back in 2018? It's a rhetorical question. It's cost. Cable, the tried and true option for over 50 years, cable television brings shows and movies straight into customers' homes via signals transmitted through coaxial or fiber optic cables, as well as over the airwaves. Originating in the United States in the late 1940s, cable television was designed to improve reception of network broadcasts in remote areas. It wasn't until the 1960s when cable was introduced to metropolitan areas as a way to resolve issues with tall buildings blocking over-the-air broadcast. Then satellite, like cable, brings shows straight into consumer homes. However, unlike cable, signals are delivered to viewers by relaying them from a communication satellite orbiting the Earth, with features like ease of accessibility and exceptional high-definition quality. Customers across the globe have taken advantage of the unique service since the first communication satellite was launched into space on July the 23rd in 1962. Cable TV costs have risen to a tipping point that cord cutting is now accelerating. The cable companies have only themselves to blame for losing subscribers. You are not informed of the hidden extra charges when you subscribe. They are continually increasing the monthly cost with small amounts, so it's not noticed until the price hit your consciousness. You are told that the additional channels have been added for your enjoyment, but the typical viewer is not interested, nor do they want the extra programming channels. Cable companies are no longer under any illusions that they can keep customers from cutting the cord. That's one of the key takeaways in a new report from analyst firm Moffitt Nathanson, which recently hosted a cord-cutting-themed summit in which it discussed the future of pay TV industry with the major stakeholders. Michael Nathanson and Craig Moffitt said the market is rife with disruption and may have reached a cord-cutting tipping point whereby pay TV operators are in survival mode. doubling down on their more profitable customers and letting price-conscious ones cancel their cable subscriptions and sign up for streaming services instead. The focus of the cable companies is on growing the profitable subscriber base and moving away from offering discounts and promotions for subscribers who do not generate profits. Today, there is a bifurcated marketplace where many subscribers are still happy with the existing pay TV bundle, while there's also a growing number of customers who are more price-oriented. It's not a new phenomenon. The industry has known for a while now that cord-cutting is a rapidly accelerating trend. Some providers were probably still in denial, and so offering special rates to subscribers who are just going to cut the cord after the rate expires doesn't really make any sense. Comcast is now focused more on selling high-margin internet services. There is broad consensus in the industry that discounted cable rates are a losing proposition in the world of cord-cutting, and a losing proposition in a world where cord-cutting will continue, and it is estimated that 40% of the current pay TV subscriber base is at risk for cutting the cord within the next 5 years. Technological changes have disrupted the once comfortable market of cable television. The TV schedule is no longer a factor. Viewers today can stream selected programs and view them at their convenience, and they are no longer tethered to the traditional television set. Their programs can be received and viewed on platform of their choice. It was around this point that television began to lose its definition. After all, what was TV if not a thing that came into your home at a specified time on a recurring schedule? And what was television if not something you watch on your television set? That's now in the past. The new television didn't just mean more TV. It meant a different kind of TV. It meant shows that didn't cater to the median viewer and that in many cases asked more from their audiences than casual background appreciation. This is a weird territory we're getting into. Nothing is too niche. The idea of television isn't to appeal to everyone all at once, but to appeal to everyone in fragments and pieces, serving one narrow interest at a time. That's what television is today. Thinking about cutting cable? Well, here's a look at what options you have available. Viewers chose to scale back on their subscriptions simply because they didn't use the services as much as they thought they would. Fortunately, more and more streaming options are becoming available every day, including the recently launched Disney Plus. Some don't even make the switch, instead choosing to forego cable or satellite TV from the get-go. While some don't start out as cable or satellite users, others see the benefit of cutting out the extra stuff they don't use. Streaming services like Hulu Plus Live TV, Sling TV, and YouTube TV has features that allow users to watch broadcasts from local stations too, oftentimes helping customers make their decisions. When it comes to enjoying TV and movies, the options can be a bit overwhelming. A quick internet search returns dozens of possibilities, each offering unique content and options to watch. Today, Netflix is a media services provider and production company that features subscription-based streaming of an online library of films and TV programs produced both in-house and by other companies. And then you have Hulu that was released to the public back in 2008. Hulu is a U.S.-based subscription video on-demand service that offers original content as well as content from partners along with ad and ad-free options. Hulu also includes add-on options to give viewers the opportunity to live TV, HBO, Cinemax, and Showtime. Then there's Amazon Prime Video. Amazon Prime Video is a video on demand service that's developed, owned, and operated by Amazon. It offers TV shows and films from rent or purchase, as well as original content and licensed partnerships. All of this is included in an Amazon Prime subscription. Amazon's video service was introduced in 2006 and was rebranded several times before becoming Prime Video in December 2016. Disney Plus, the newest streaming service, was just recently launched. Disney Plus is a subscription video on-demand service. focusing on the film and TV content produced by Disney Studios and Disney Television. Disney Plus features original films and TV series based on new and existing properties, as well as content from Disney, 20th Century Fox, Lucasfilm, Star Wars, Marvel, National Geographic, and Pixar. Disney Plus users have the option to expand their plan to include a Hulu subscription as well as ESPN Plus. Then there's Sling TV, the first live TV streaming service. Sling TV was launched in February of 2015. It allowed subscribers to watch a collection of live and on-demand TV channels on their internet devices. It's basically cable without the cable. Sling TV offers two tiers of options for viewers to choose from, as well as add-ons like NFL Red Zone, National Hockey League Network, HBO, Showtime, and others. Well, entertainment isn't cheap, which is why it's one of the first categories to get the snip. When the pocketbook gets a bit tight, however, there are ways to trim excess if needed, especially when it comes to TV. Streaming services all start around the same price, $5.99, $6.99, and $8.99 for Hulu, Disney Plus, and Netflix, respectively, while Sling TV comes at the priciest of the bunch, starting at $25 per month. All of the services include add-ons. Hulu has the option to watch without ads for a few dollars more than the initial price and include month-to-month subscriptions. Is T-Mobile nationwide 5G, or is it just a slightly faster 4G? AT&T and Verizon's tendency to dramatically overstate availability and overly ambitious marketing has resulted in consumers' first contact with 5G as generally one of disappointment. That's not to say that 5G won't be a solid improvement when it arrives at scale, just that carriers were abundantly eager to overstate what 5G can do and where it's available, and didn't stop to think that they were doing the technology a disservice. The latest case in point, T-Mobile proudly proclaimed it had launched America's first nationwide 5G network. But a more detailed look at actual availability finds that by nationwide, T-Mobile means about 60% of the U.S. When pressed for clarification, the company wasn't ready to give you an answer. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates the population to be more than 330 million people, and T-Mobile hasn't actually forgotten about the other 130 million people in the United States, as a sentence halfway through the carrier's press release notes, that T-Mobile's network covers more than 60% of the population. At 1 million square miles, the carrier's 5G network also covers about 28% of the country's 3.5 million square miles, and is far short of the geographical reach already provided by T-Mobile's 4G network. T-Mobile was asked to explain why it defines nationwide as 60% of the population. T-Mobile initially didn't answer the question, but later they attempted to defend its claim that the National Advertising Division of the Better Business Bureau declares anything over 200 million to be nationwide. But the National Advertising Division is a largely toothless, self-regulatory apparatus designated to help the industry forestall any meaningful governmental punishment for false advertising. Its definition of nationwide is a meaningless to the broader public and factual reality. Either you're actually deploying 5G to everybody, or you're not. One plus side of T-Mobile's 5G launch, at least it's not charging consumers extra to access the network. Although you can probably expect that to change post-merger when sector competition is weakened. Though there's another issue with T-Mobile's claims, that its 5G network is somehow revolutionary. The company's initial implementation of 5G isn't really all that much faster than the existing 4G network. Given this initial launch largely relies on the same 600 MHz spectrum it uses for 4G, not the millimeter wave spectrum that offers lesser range but notably faster speeds. The 5G service that T-Mobile announced isn't much faster than T-Mobile's 4G service. That's because the nationwide 5G covering 60% of the population uses the same 600 MHz spectrum that T-Mobile already uses for 4G. The big speed increases on 5G are expected to come from millimeter wave spectrum, but those higher frequencies don't travel as far and are being used primarily in densely populated urban areas. Again, faster, more reliable networks are always good, but they're not magic. But since just okay doesn't make for headlines, carriers have resorted to dramatically overstating what the standard can do, in turn associating 5G in the minds of the public with marketing hype. As 5G moves from hype to everyday reality, those of us in North America will get the good stuff the fastest, says a new report. 5G wireless may not change everything, as a lot of the hype around this technology loves to promise, but a new report from wireless infrastructure provider Ericsson suggests it's going to make our smartphones even more of a streaming media with better video. And those of us in North America will make the move to 5G more rapidly than those elsewhere. The November 2019 edition of the Ericsson Mobility Report predicts that this next generation of mobile broadband will see its first big year in 2020 and account for almost three-quarters of all mobile subscriptions in North America just 5 years later. The rest of the world, however, will move more slowly, says Stockholm-based Ericsson, with the next highest 5G adoption rates seen in Northeast Asia, 56% 5G by 2025, and Western Europe, 55% by 2025. Countries within these regions have developed economies enabling a high adoption rate of information and communications technology. In Central and Eastern Europe, only 25% of mobile subscriptions will be 5G by 2025, and in the rest of the world, the figures are still lower. That adds up to only 2.6 billion 5G subscriptions in 2025 out of 8.9 billion total. If there is a global race to 5G, as politicians like to say, but this report doesn't bear that out. The figures throughout this report suggest much of the world isn't following it with an excess of enthusiasm. A judicious reading of this report offers some key reasons why you might not want to get too giddy about 5G just yet. One of the limits of 5G circuitry in the early 5G phones now available lacks the more integrated designs, reduced power consumption, and more frequencies and network operation modes of the second generation of 5G devices coming next year. Another is the long-term difficulty of building out 5G coverage. Ericsson's optimistic forecast post 5G reaching 65% of the world's population by 2025, but 10% of all that will have to come from dynamically shared spectrum today reserved for 4G LTE. And most of this 5G coverage will not happen via the ultra-fast but short-range millimeter wave service, the focus of much of the 5G sales pitch in the United States. Even though the millimeter wave 5G coverage remains vanishingly scarce on the ground. Outside of dense urban areas, 5G will have to ride on lower frequency bands that reach further but don't offer the gigabit speeds so often touted for 5G. It took 4G LTE 7 years to get to 65% population coverage, so on paper, a 55 to 65% 5G target by 2025, well, that's not unreasonable. Ericsson's report is, however, quite direct in stating that 5G will drive data usage through the roof. In North America, it calls for average smartphone data traffic to increase by a factor of more than 5, from 8.5 gigabytes per user a month in 2019 to 45 gigabytes a month in 2025. Western Europe will take second place in this bandwidth binge contest, going from 8.8 gigabyte to 36 gigabyte a month. Worldwide, Ericsson predicts a jump from 7.2 gigabyte to 24 gigabyte a month. Ericsson cites real-world data from the South Korean firm SK Telecom, which found that its 5G subscribers use almost three times as much data as their 4G counterpart in September, where 26.6 gigabyte versus 5.95 gigabyte. streaming video will drive soaring data usage up through the roof. Note that these are average figures that can reflect a minority of intense to incessant users, not median numbers that would indicate what a typical level of use might be. And median smartphone data usage numbers can be much lower. The research indicated that this year that while the United States average in the first quarter was 8 gigabytes a month, the median use was just 3.9 gigabytes. In Ericsson's analysis, streaming video will drive those soaring data usage levels by 2025. The report expects that video will grow by 30% a year to go up to 76% of all mobile traffic. That will be enough to shrink the share of social media, the second biggest usage category, even though that traffic itself will rise 20% a year in Ericsson's view. The video we watch over 5G connections won't just come at higher resolutions than today. Currently, in the United States, most service plans constrain streaming media to a DVD-like 480p resolution, even if the network could support faster streaming instead. Ericsson suggests we'll watch more immersive formats, augmented reality and virtual reality. The report points again to early experiences in Korea. For example, SK Telecom's Sercho virtual reality service enables multiple users to experience sports events and movies together in a virtual environment as if they were in the same physical location. Augmented reality video, in which augmented reality apps overlay content over the real-world scenery, as shown either on your phone screen or in-head glasses, doesn't have the hang-up, but it is also yet to drive much business for SK Telecom. Present augmented reality services are mostly proof-of-concept services, paving the way for more advanced augmented reality services in the future. The notion that 5G will result in more of us walking around with AR and VR headsets may be a bit of a stretch to take when we're already swamped with 5G hype. But give Ericsson's authors credit for showing this much constraint. The word 6G appears nowhere in their report. Stay tuned.
Mark Liasso has a review on Western Digital My Passport.
I'm Mark Liasso with On the Mark. We live in a digital world, and we all need more portable storage, especially while on the move. The WD My Passport has a new group of portable hard disk drives that store from 1 to 5 terabytes. They measure about 4 inches by 3 inches and less than half an inch in height, about the size of a thin sardine tin, and have a ripple feature for secure grip. Hard disk drives, or HDDs, have a read-write head that in nanoseconds stores data on a spinning disk. Western Digital strongly advises not to move the drive while manipulating data. Most portable drives offer limited 2-year warranties. The WD My Passport offers 3. The My Passport draws power from your computer to perform activities. The spinning drive generates a low-volume hiss, so low that the microphone couldn't record the sound. A small white light shows your drive is active. The WD Discovery Suite gives options like automatic backup and silent online updates. It can even turn off the activity light. In terms of operation, the more expensive solid-state drives are faster and there's less chance of damaged files. With hard disk drives, large files are written in contiguous blocks. As the drive fills with data, large files are broken up and stored in available blocks. This can lead to fragmented files requiring maintenance, like defragging your drive with the included WD utilities. The My Passport is easy to use with Windows 10 or 8.1. Mac and other platforms require reformatting. I took the unit out of the box, attached the micro USB 3.2 cable, plugged into a Microsoft Surface Pro, and the WD Discovery software did the rest, offering to connect with social media and cloud services like Dropbox or Google Drive. Scheduled backups can be made using the WD Drive utilities. There's a password option. If you use it, copy your password to a secure location. There isn't a password recovery program. I transferred 25 gigs to the My Passport in 4 minutes and 6 seconds, roughly a gigabyte in 10 seconds, and the equivalent to approximately 5 DVDs. As a cost-saving strategy, you can reduce your cloud storage fees by downloading to the My Passport. This is important when you can't connect to the cloud. You'll have data in hand, so to speak. Good news? Hard disk drives are 3 to 4 times less expensive than solid-state drives. Shop around. As I mentioned earlier, the My Passport has password protection using built-in 256-bit AES hardware encryption. It's ideal for road warriors or researchers working with sensitive data. Graphic artists and engineers or architects will find it handy while on a job site. Musicians and audio engineers that need portability and affordability can use it to store large sound files and production notes. The WD My Passport external drives are easy to use, available in black, blue, or red. The 1 tera and 5 terabyte drives are available in black. Each unit comes with an 18-inch SuperSpeed USB cable. As HankKey reminds us to back up our data, using the automatic backup feature puts the Western Digital My Passport on the mark. I'm Mark Leosa.
Thank you, Mark. How to refresh Windows 10 without a factory reset? You've been running Windows 10 and it has accumulated bloatware, crapware, that is causing the system to be sluggish. You can do a factory reset, but that means you have to go through all the updates, and it gets trickier for those trying to do a factory reset with Windows 7 or 8.1 in the hidden partition. So what can be done to clear the clutter on your computer? Thankfully, Microsoft has included a robust Windows 10 tool that can clean up the system and still enable you to maintain an updated operating system. The tool is officially known as Fresh Start, and as the name hints, it will reset your system and install only the stuff that is required to run Windows 10. Before running Fresh Start, do a full image backup of what you have on the computer. Murphy's Law is you may wish you had if you had encountered a mishap running Fresh Start. Run this with AC power on and not rely on battery power operation. To get started, do a search on the following: Microsoft Windows 10 Fresh Start to access the tool. Fresh Start lets you perform a clean reinstallation and update of Windows 10 while keeping your personal data and most Windows settings intact. In some cases, a clean installation may improve your device startup and shutdown experience, memory usage, Microsoft Store apps performance, browsing experience, and battery life. Note, Fresh Start doesn't delete the files and folders stored on your computer. Still, it is recommended backup of your data before doing anything. So, this is how you can remove all the bloatware apps from your Windows 10 PC. You should note that Windows does not remove third-party apps that are present in Microsoft Store. The rest will be kicked out, which you can reinstall later if you want. In addition to your personal data, the Fresh Start feature also retains some of your Windows settings during the process. It updates your system to the latest Windows 10 version, so you don't have to download any big updates later on. Furthermore, this removal tool keeps a note of the exact date and time when you last used it, so it can be helpful for reference later on. Using Fresh Start is different than factory resetting your PC. In the latter, your computer goes back to the state in which it was shipped from the factory. That means it will bring back all the unwanted bloatware that you were trying to remove in the first place. Now, as I mentioned, the Fresh Start tool doesn't eliminate any Microsoft Store app from your computer. One final note, you may not need Fresh Start today, but download it now when you can. If the system is really misbehaving, you may have problems trying to download this app when it's needed.
Benjamin Rockwell in his IT Pro series, auditing computers for hardware software patches.
What would we do without technology in the workplace? This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is where I put on the work hat and I talk about those things that happen at the office with technology. In this case, I want to talk about inventory management software. And no, I'm not talking about warehouse inventory. I'm talking about specifically with your IT situation. You may not be aware of this. In many companies, and this starts even at the small end of the scale, your SMB space, small to medium-sized businesses, even when we start talking about 100 PCs or even a little bit less than that, all the way on up to organizations which have thousands upon thousands of computers, there's an inventory of all of those. And this inventory goes into a number of different directions. Now, I'm going to drop a few names here. It doesn't matter. You don't need to keep notes on this unless you're really into this kind of thing. But I want to give you sort of a background of all of this that's going on. One of the basic versions out there is something called Spiceworks. And Spiceworks is one that I've dealt with on a regular basis. There are a few others out there. There's a company called SolarWinds. There's something called Capterra. There's ManageEngine. I know that there are many of them out there. It doesn't matter which one. And what they're doing is they are inventorying your entire hardware and software situation. What do I mean by this? So Spiceworks, this is one that you can download for free. This is for small companies. Generally, it's not going to work in a large organization that has thousands of computers, but it'll work for this. Again, if you got 100 computers, it'll work fine. So it goes forward and it sends out a signal to all of the individual computers on the network. And even more than that, it'll even identify some of the printers and some of your copiers and some of the other devices that are connected to your network. Now, when we send out that signal, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about ManageEngine or Spiceworks or whatever, we can then query that particular address. We can ask for information. We can say, hey, you at this particular IP address, what do you have? What are you? And that software can find out by asking a number of different questions all of the identifiable characteristics of a computer. For instance, we can tell that it is a Dell system. We can tell that it's a Dell system running Windows. We can tell that it's a specific Dell laptop with this particular serial number and this particular support number. And then we can then have that system contact Dell and say, here's the serial number. When is the warranty due on this system? What did it originally come with? Okay, so now we know how much memory it has, how much memory it had when we purchased it, how big of a hard drive it has right now, how much when we purchased it, and so forth and so on. And then we can also get into what version of Windows, what patch release, what version of Microsoft Office, what patch releases were done there. But let's go across that entire hard drive and let's query the system for every single piece of software that's on there. Now, where this comes into all kinds of value here is in a support organization, we can pull up that computer and we can say, oh, here's your problem. Here's why you can't open up a PDF file, because you don't have Adobe Acrobat loaded on your system. Some of these systems, Spiceworks, actually has a way for you to push Adobe Acrobat Reader or any one of a number of other software packages out. So you see how this is all working out? You see what we can do? There's all kinds of power that's coming along with this inventory management software. Not only can we find out what you have, but we can find out what you're missing. We can send whatever it is that you're missing. And this is a world that I've really enjoyed playing with. This is something that is very valuable when we talk about managing all of the different patch levels. One of the biggest vulnerabilities when we talk about companies is the various big, huge holes left behind when you aren't updating the software on a regular basis. The bad guys come along, they see holes, and they try to attack those holes and put viruses and malware and everything else that you might imagine on that computer. So we have to patch all of the systems. Now we get back into that inventory management. We can find out we have 100 computers here. 23 of them do not patch the latest bug. So let's go on out and let's fix that bug. Oh, better yet, we can do it via remote. All you have to do is press this button, bump, 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 bump. All 23 of those are patched right away. The power that is available in modern IT is amazing. And this audit package, whether it's Spiceworks or ManageEngine or any of the rest of these, this audit software can make sure that your organization is running as efficiently as it can, that it is able to address all of the problems of the business as best you can up front. If you are in IT, I would suggest that you go ahead and you make sure that you have something like this in place. Even in those smaller companies, even if you've got only a matter of 20 or 30 or 40 computers, this will save you time, this will save you energy, and it will keep you compliant when, oh yes, auditors come knocking on the door and saying, hey, how many computers do you have? This is also good for recovering. If you've got a disaster recovery plan, you need to know exactly what computers you have in-house. This is used in so many different directions. It's an exciting world, and it's something fun. Check it out. One big place to check it out, spiceworks.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. FBI recommends that you keep your Internet of Things devices on a separate network. The FBI also recommends changing factory set default passwords and not allowing an Internet of Devices accompanying mobile app to gain access to too many smartphone permissions. We now have smart speakers, smart thermostats, smart doorbells, smart television, smart refrigerators, and the list seems endless. The security on these are not tightly integrated with each other. Google doesn't have all their devices integrated with each other. The FBI says owners of Internet of Things devices should isolate the equipment on a separate Wi-Fi network, separate from the one they're using for their primary devices, such as laptops, desktops, or smartphones. Your refrigerator and your laptop should not be on the same network. Keep your most private sensitive data on a separate system from your other Internet of Devices. The same advice, to keep the devices on a separate Wi-Fi network or LAN, has been shared in the past by multiple IT and security experts. The reasoning behind it is simple. By keeping all the Internet of Things equipment on a separate network, any compromise of a smart device will not grant an attacker a direct route to a user's primary devices, where most of their data is stored. Jumping across the two networks would require considerable effort from the attacker. However, placing primary devices and Internet of Things devices on separate networks might not sound that easy for non-technical users. The simplest way is to use two routers. The smarter way is to use what is called microsegmentation, a feature found in the firmware of most Wi-Fi routers, which allows router admins to create virtual networks. Virtual networks will behave as different networks, even they effectively run on the same router. While isolating Internet of Things devices on their own network is the best course of action for both home users and companies alike, this wasn't the FBI's only advice on dealing with the Internet of Things devices. Change the device's factory settings from the default password. A simple Internet search should tell you how, and if you can't find the information, consider moving on to another product. Passwords should be as long as possible and unique for Internet of Things devices. Many connected devices are supported by mobile apps on your phone. These apps could be running in the background and using default permissions that you never realize you approved. Know what kind of personal information those apps are collecting and say no to privilege requests that don't make sense. Make sure that all your devices are updated regularly, especially when you're adding another device each time to the network. If automatic updates are available for software, hardware, and operating systems, turn them on. The FBI claimed that hackers who take over one of today's feature smart television would be able to spy on device owners through the built-in cameras. While this is prudent advice, it is worth mentioning that there have not been any known cases of this happening with hackers taking over smart TV and spying on its owner. There is no standard across the industry for Internet of Things devices. And the easiest probably is to just get another router and keep it on a separate network if you're not sure of how to set up it on the same router.
Presenting Marty Winston. Why you can see in 2D, but hearing needs 4D.
Hey, are you driving right now? Listen, when you're not driving, not moving, I want you to take a good look at any sign or any photo, anything flat. Now close one eye and keep looking. That sign or picture is flat, two-dimensional, having only width and height, and that's all it needs to have for you to be able to see it. Now, look around you with both eyes open at things that are not as flat as a sign or a picture, but still things that aren't moving, and you don't move either. You get a real sense of depth, right? With two eyes, human vision can see in 3D. Of course, there's another kind of 3D that you're able to see, but you may not think of it as 3D. Remember the last time you watched a movie or a cartoon? The individual images are only two-dimensional. They just have height and width, but they change over time. And time is a dimension, too. So watching TV or movies or cartoon animation is a different kind of seeing in 3D. It could have been 4D, four dimensions, but because there's no implicit depth to the images, it's really just two-dimensional images against time, 3D. Want to see in four dimensions? That's easy. Just keep an eye on traffic or people walking down the street or animals or birds or anything with length and width and depth that changes over time. Motion. That's what makes it 3D. I think everybody gets it now. Ever since Einstein brought up the intertwined relationship between time and space, well, it's confused issues for some people and clarified them for others. I'm hoping my examples can help you find a cozy place in the clarified column, and there's a reason for it. A lot of companies, it seems like a dozen every year, keep coming out with claims about 3D. That's the one they keep claiming, that are simply not true. I've been talking about human vision, how we're able to see 2D and two kinds of 3D and 4D. We don't even think about it. That part is easy for me to explain because it's about things we're seeing all the time. Seeing is easy to understand. The hard part to explain is hearing. And let me alert you here and now that there is no such thing as 3D sound. Anytime a product claims to offer that, they're either deliberately lying or they're ignorant of how audio actually works. And before I help you understand how audio actually works, don't worry, I'm not going to get too crazy with this. Let's start with things you've already heard. Back when audio stopped being monaural and they added a second channel, separating those two channels into left and right channels, stereo was born. That was what stereo was, two channels, left and right. And one of the first things that every stereo shop had playing, and that almost every new stereo owner bought, was a stereo demonstration record. You could very vividly hear cars or planes going from one side to the other. You might even guess exactly how much to turn your head to directly face them. this binaural sound, binaural, that's just a word that means two ears, so you're hearing separately in each ear. That kind of sound could give you a sense of compass-like direction, the angle. Azimuth is the technical term, the angle you had a sense of where in a circle the sound source originated. Now remember, that's a flat circle. Later, when home theater brought us 5.1 surround sound, the speakers behind you made the direction of rearward sound sources also become more apparent and often somewhat separated from the front. And that's okay, but it was still just where on a flat circle they might be located. It was only two-dimensional positioning. So let's add a third dimension. And this will call for a little bit of imagination. Imagine being in the middle of a circle surrounded by tall ladders, and every ladder having three musicians on it, one at the top, one in the middle, and one on the bottom. Stereo can't give you any kind of a clue of whether a trumpet player is at a top rung or in the middle of the ladder or the bottom level. You just can't tell. Neither can surround sound. You would need a lot more channels. And even then, let's be clear, you might be able to identify the position of any one instrument in three dimensions. You might fairly call that 3D positioning, but it still isn't 3D audio. Here's the reason. Human beings can only hear four-dimensional sound. Let me say that another way. If there are less than four dimensions to a sound source, you can't hear it, not even in monaural. And here's where what you learned about sound in school may be confusing you. When schools introduce the subject of sound, it's usually with a two-dimensional image of a waveform, maybe a sine wave to represent a tone, maybe a more complex audio envelope, but just a rectangular image. Know why? Because that's the only alternative available when printing textbooks. You may have seen the same squiggles on oscilloscopes in science fiction movies. If you just hook up a microphone to a scope's input and follow the voltage that represents the relative loudness of the signal, that's what it looks like. Well, anyway, that's the most common way to look at it. So instead of thinking of those rectangular two-dimensional waveforms as signal readings, you're left thinking that's what sound looks like, but it isn't. It's just a cross-section. Hold your hands out at arm's length, even with your lips and your palm facing you, and blow a brief puff of air. Now, you'll notice that it takes a fraction of a second to feel that puff of air reach your hand. That puff of air is much closer to the true fabric of sound. But let's expand on that. You've seen ripples on the water, right? They have length and width and depth. And if they're not moving, that's all they have. But they are moving. That's what makes them ripples. So they have four dimensions, length and width and depth and changes over time. Now, have you ever seen anybody blow smoke rings? They start at the lips and expand outward, each ring remaining its own thing until it dissipates, like cloudy little donuts growing while you watch. That's a slow-motion version of how sound works. We hear sound when something moves air at changing rates. Maybe our breath through our larynx, the voice box, maybe the cone on a speaker, maybe the diaphragm on a headphone. In every case, the airflow, meaning the immediate air pressure, is always changing. Those very rapidly changing puffs of air pressure are what we call sound. Those puffs exist, like the ripples, in three dimensions. You could feel that blowing of a puff at your hand. It has a beginning and end, so you have a sense of three dimensions. So you have these pressure puffs, these pressure ripples in the air, but you can't hear a thing if they're not changing. So for human beings, sound requires, mandates, four dimensions. The three dimensions of that volume of air, and because it has to change for you to hear anything, that fourth dimension, time. When I get pitched by some PR agency parrot on a new client's miraculous three-dimensional sound, my first question is, can you guess? Really? Which dimension did they leave out? And does it really matter if it's impossible for humans to hear sound in three dimensions in any case? Yeah, I'm a smart aleck. Well, they're not going to snooker me. And now if you've paid even just a little attention, they won't be able to bamboozle you either. But wait a minute, because there's something that human hearing can do that electronics can't, at least not yet. We have the brains for it, and they don't. We're conscious of our brains being involved at a content level, interpreting what we hear as to meaning. But there's more than that happening, more than we're consciously aware of. The pressure waves that carry sound, and that are sound, will arrive at our ears at very slightly different times, which our brains consider when determining where a sound is coming from. There may also be differences in when each ear picks up on the high and low pressure waves, their phase, which is a result of, among other things, microechoes as sound bounces off things around us. More positioning hints. And our heads are always moving, even just a little like steering an antenna. And again, that gives our brains still more data. So if we're in that room with the orchestra members on ladders, even blindfolded, we can tell which instruments are higher off the ground, which in the middle, and which lower. You might even be surprised by how much of that sense of orientation still exists for people who can only hear through one ear. And while we're at it, a lot of this is very closely related to how we maintain our balance. That's enough of that. Next time, my subject is CES. Now, that used to stand for the Consumer Electronics Show, but that's shifting. And when it opens in the second week of January, a lot of what will be there isn't anything you'd consider as consumer electronics. Okay, some of it is, but not as much as there used to be. If you're consumed with curiosity, join me.
Thank you, Marty. I see the light at the end of the tunnel. I see Santa has just completed his checklist before taking off. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open and free to the public. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 12th, 6:45 p.m., in the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation, Transitioning from Windows 7 to Windows 10, and I'll be part of that presentation. Thursday, December the 12th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. That's in Manhattan, New York, and check at the front desk for the room number, and bring a photo with you for personal ID. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. We hope to see you at some of these meetings, and if you have an announcement for me to make regarding your meetings, just send me a note at hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.